podcasts. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hells and today I'm speaking to Emma Heath, course facilitator for the Recovery Course, which helps bring freedom from addiction. Emma, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to start with just talking a little bit about your story. There's a very good reason, of course, why you work for something called the Recovery Course. You know what it's like to battle addiction, and that started from an early age for you, didn't it?
It did, yes, at about the age of 11. I began misbehaving around food, actually. It started with anorexia, went on to bulimia. I've been through the whole spectrum of food addictions and food disorders.
Very young. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Somerset, a little place, a little village called Banwell, outside of Weston-super-Mare. Lovely place, you know, really nice upbringing. My mother gave me absolutely everything I could wish for. She was a really well respected pharmacist, and you know, my dad had left when I was tiny, 15 months old. He left. He worked for Guinness, ironically.
A good family upbringing.
Yeah, well, my mum gave me absolutely everything I could wish for. She gave myself and my brother everything we could have wanted. Really well educated. My grandparents were around. Obviously, being a lone parent, she was out at work a lot, but she still would give and devote as much time as she could with us. We couldn't have asked for more, really.
Mm. So where do you think the kind of problems came in? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I don't blame anything. I believe that there's contributing factors to making anybody, you know, go off the rails a bit. But there were times where I thought not having a dad around and different things like that, and I was bullied at school, and my brother turned to drugs at quite a young age too. So, you know, my brother and I didn't get on very well at all, actually. You know, it escalated to me needing a restraining order on him at one point, but, you know, I've been able to forgive him for that because it was all drug-fueled. But I don't see there was one particular thing. It was just this whole... A deep-rooted feeling inside of not feeling good enough.
And where was faith at this point? Was there any kind of Christian background or upbringing?
Yeah, well, my mum is a very strong Christian, and my grandparents, you know, I was brought up in a Christian home, and we were talking about God all the time. I used to be in this, it was called a FOG group, which was Friends of God. As kids, it was a child's group, and there were Bible studies, and we used to play football with other churches. And so I remember always being around a church environment. But as I grew up, I'll be honest, I really enjoyed the taste of communion when I got, you know, confirmed. And not that that attributed to me becoming, you know, dependent on alcohol, but it did. I enjoyed that kind of the rebellious streak in me. And yeah, it kind of just escalated through my teenage years.
Yeah. So it started with a problem, as you say, around food. And what kind of happened next? What did that escalate into in your teenage years?
Well, bizarrely, it felt like I could control something, because I felt my life was a little out of control with the difficulty between my brother and I. And, you know, food was the one thing I could control by not having or having too much of. And it almost ingrained that kind of addictive nature, which then manifested into, you know, I'd go through the different food elements. But when I found alcohol, that was when my journey really kind of took off around addiction. And I think I was about 13 when I started drinking. Mm. And it was fun, it was, you know, sociable, and I felt I fitted in. And it also blocked out a bit of the pain I was feeling around the stuff with my brother, so.
Yeah, and how did that develop and get worse over time? I mean, presumably this started kind of small social drinking and then escalated further?
Yeah, it was, you know, a group of us that would buy, you know, cider together on the weekends, that kind of, you know, it happens a lot, you know, binge drinking at teenage years. And before I knew it, I was drinking a lot, but I didn't really notice I had a problem with it. I knew I was a heavy drinker, but I didn't think of it in a sort of alcoholic way or anything like that. It wasn't until I look back on some of the decisions I made, I see how alcohol really influenced my life. So it became more and more and more, to the point when I went to university, it really, really took off around that whole party scene, and you could almost disguise how much you drank. I did really well at school, and I got offered all the degrees pretty much that I wanted to do. And I remember going to Cardiff Uni and they said to me, you can do this degree, that degree. And they said like business studies and sports recreation. And then they said hospitality management. And they said that there was wine tasting on a Friday with that course. And I signed up within seconds.
Amazing.
So, you know, I made a 4-year decision based on the fact of having a bit of a drink.
Right. And you hadn't realised at that point this might be becoming a bit of a problem?
No, not at all. It was just socially acceptable. And that's the hard thing around any addiction. It can be socially acceptable. And there's a very fine line before it crosses over into being, you know, problematic. And, you know, for me, I think I'd crossed that line already, but I hadn't seen it. So I used to go out at university and being in Cardiff, I got very much into the rugby and, you know, the Six Nations and things. And I used to go out drinking with the Welsh rugby team, and I thought it was the best compliment ever when they told me I drank too much. And that was just the way my life became. It became a lot dominated by the drinking. I liked every sport going. I was involved with the cricket club, the golf club, the Formula One team, you know, groups. Yeah. You name it, I liked it because I could have a different group of drinking buddies.
And by the time you reached university, was sort of church and God still a factor in your life, or had that gone to one side?
It had gone to one side, to be honest. I mean, I've always believed, you know, I've always knew God was with me. My gosh, you know, he carried me through some pretty horrific times, and, you know, and I had that ingrained belief. But the more I drank, the more further I felt I pushed sort of God away.
You're at university, and you mentioned that you took this course based partly on the idea of the free wine tasting.
Yep.
What happened next?
I did really well at it, even though I was drinking heavily. I made some really good friends. It was at that time that I, you know, things with my brother had got really bad, so I couldn't actually go home to the family home for my own safety. But I made good friends at uni and left university, had a relationship with a guy, and, you know, just life kind of went on. But I realised that I moved to a place near Portsmouth, and I ended up realising I was drinking every evening. And again, I didn't really see it as a massive problem. I'd work hard and then come home, have a glass of wine, which would turn into a bottle or two. But before I knew it, I ended up going away on a holiday, actually, abroad, and ended up running nightclubs in Turkey for a couple of years. And it was only when I left there after a few years, and it wasn't glamorous, you know, doing this. It was just, you know, around drink all the time. And it was when I was on a flight back, having left a really abusive relationship, actually, and I was in a real mess, like physically and emotionally, but I didn't have any drink for several hours because the flight had been delayed. And it was then that I realised I started having the withdrawals from alcohol, and it was a really... It scared me. It scared me because I think deep down I knew I was a heavy drinker and that, but to actually have physical side effects of withdrawal was quite shocking for me.
I was reading your story, and you mentioned that at one point you were abroad and kidnapped. Is that something that happened in Turkey?
Yeah, it was. The relationship I was in... basically, I'd lost every sense of who I was out there. I felt so distant from God, and my family, and everything that I believed in. And I think seeing a culture, and I love all religions and all cultures, don't get me wrong, but it was the traditions that went hand in hand with being over there. I saw the real corrupt way that people were treated, especially women out there. And this gentleman that I... was in a relationship with, he'd actually been promised to a lady to be married, and I didn't know, and it all just erupted, and he ended up getting very, very violent and locked me in my apartment. But because I was in such a state around drink, I as long as he brought me my drink every day,
right,
I just stayed in there, which he'd locked me in, and it was probably for about a month. You know, but it was just after that I managed to get out of that situation and got back to Britain.
Yeah, and it was on the plane that you realised, had that moment where you thought, hang on, this is becoming a problem, having those physical side effects to not drinking for a few hours.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I remember just, I was so confused by so much that had gone on and felt so disconnected with everything. But then with this physical effect happening in my body, I realised I was in trouble. You know, I was one of the rock bottoms I've had in my life.
I was going to ask you, what was the kind of rock bottom before your story flips? And of course, we're about to come to that moment where everything changed and your life took a drastically new direction. But what was the final kind of rock bottom moment that resulted in that change?
Well, I think for anybody in addiction, I think there can be quite a few different factors and different forms of rock bottoms, which is something that's not really commonly spoke about, because I think for me, that was probably the physical rock bottom where I actually realised, I did continue drinking when I got back, and then the physical side effects probably did get worse, but the physical can be for quite a prolonged period. I had a very, an emotional and spiritual rock bottom later on in my journey, which was when I'd had years sober, but then I drank again, and that was probably the worst emotional and spiritual rock bottom I had, because I only had one option really, to get my life back on track. But yeah, I see rock bottoms as an opportunity to grab hold of, and that's sadly where so many people hit a rock bottom and they don't have the tools or the people around them or the resources to change and then get, a relationship back with God.
Yeah.
Whereas I've been really blessed that people have been in my path.
So when you had that kind of first moment, coming back to the UK after being in Turkey and that being, as you say, one of the rock bottoms, did things change from that moment? Was there the kind of help to for you to change direction?
The thing is, I think I wanted to get well, and I knew I needed to, but the two seemed so different. Mm-hmm. It was when the two combined together that it's almost like gives you that propulsion to actually start on a recovery journey. I went for years, literally just trying to get better, accessing services, not Christian services, general kind of services in the community. And it was almost like, sort of a hamster on a wheel, just round and round. I'd get a few days, a few weeks, and then I'd be back to square one and completely baffled. And that's what they say about addiction. It's, cunning, baffling and powerful. And I had no tools to stay stopped. That's the problem. I could get stopped but not stay stopped. And I just kept going to all these different things and drinking. And I remember being in a flat in Wales and the Tesco delivery chap became my best friend, because that's the only person I'd see. And I'd put vodka into water bottles and walk around drinking them, thinking no one knew, but everybody knew. You can tell a mile off. But I just desperately wanted to get my life back on track and get my career going, and it was like a living hell, actually, walking around and knowing that I was deep in my heart, I would promise myself I'd never do this again. And then that later that day or the following day, I'd be in the same state, if not worse. And I'd be so upset with myself. And often we see all the carnage that people do to others, which I'm so passionate about helping now. But also I can look at Emma now and have that compassion for a person that, nobody chooses to hurt people in the way they do around addiction. I've never met one person with an addiction that said, I went out to do this.
Yeah.
We make bad choices, but, don't we all? And that's the thing. It was, I knew I needed to get well, and I had great people around me who helped me get into a treatment centre through the Pharmaceutical Society. My mother, in her profession, they helped fund me for the first few weeks, which was such a godsend, And that's where I started back on my journey.
That must have been really tough, especially initially. I mean, you already mentioned that you were having physical symptoms of withdrawing. Yeah. So presumably when you went into recovery, at least to begin with, that would have been a really tough, difficult process.
It was. And I was in a real emotional wreck when I went into treatment over 10 years ago now. But I went to the most fantastic place. I went in, I was going through a court battle because I'd lost my driving license through drink driving. And, there are a lot of consequences. I had no friends and, I'd hurt everybody around me, especially like my mum. And I went into this treatment centre and they just loved me. I didn't know who I was. I was so broken. I didn't know what I liked, what I didn't like. But the physical side effects of withdrawing, alcohol has to be kept so carefully done when you're drinking. I mean, I was drinking about 2 litres of vodka a day at the point where I went into treatment. My whole world evolved around the next bit of drink, and to then be in a place where you haven't got that, it's frightening. but it's also, it can be physically dangerous, and the, you know, the professionals have to intervene in that sort of circumstance. And they were fantastic. I mean, it was a beautiful place in Wiltshire called Clouds House, which is, it's a great organisation, and I was there for 6 weeks, and it took probably about 10 days to come gradually down off the medication they give you. But I tell this story because it's quite funny. I went to this treatment centre, and they had this cow field at the bottom of the field, and I've got a little phobia of cows. In my way, I was muddling up my words. I was in this treatment centre, and I kept saying to everybody what I thought I was saying to people, that I had a phobia of cows. I was actually telling them I had a fetish for cows. So everyone's like looking at me like I'm really strange. And I didn't know why. And then the fog cleared. You know, the fog cleared, and I realised that, I was messing my words up. But to be honest, it was the best thing that could have happened going there, because right. It was a 12-step treatment centre. And the 12 steps originate from Alcoholics Anonymous, which was originally, you know, devised by a group of Christian people, as we know. And I understand why they started saying higher power rather than God.
Right. So, yeah, so this is, as you say, it was first a Christian idea,
yeah.
And that you could call on what is now termed a higher power to help you through this recovery,
yes.
Process. But it's changed, was it? It was changed from God to higher power.
Well, I don't know if it's actually changed, but they decided to use the words higher power so
right.
that it was
accessible
to all.
To everyone, sure.
And obviously it is, you know, millions of people access it around the world. So it does what it was designed to do. But you know what I love about, you know, and we'll go on to it later, but the work I'm involved in, it brings, you know, Christianity right back into the core of the 12 steps. And you know, I think when I went to this treatment centre and saw the 12 steps originally, you know, I didn't know it, you know, I felt, why has God done this to me? You know, does God love me still? You know, all that stuff. I had a lot of questions, but I'm so grateful that I was able to explore them.
Yeah.
And bit by bit, you know, my relationship with God grew again. And, you know, I felt his love and forgiveness and compassion, and the 12 steps encapsulate all that and, you know, making amends to people and then living spiritually. So, you know, I was back on a journey.
Yeah. So it was actually through the 12-step program that you both began your recovery and, I guess, rediscovered your faith at the same time.
I did, yeah. It was a gradual process. But I'll be honest, it sort of, I had 3 or 4 years in recovery before I drank again. And during those 3 or 4 years, I started to get to know who I was a bit more. But I think I put a bit more emphasis on Emma rather than my faith journey, actually. You know, it was bubbling along. But I think looking back, you know, no wonder I probably drank again and things, because I hadn't really got a whole grip on everything.
But it's not unusual for people who have been addicted to things for years to go through recovery and to have some sort of a relapse.
Yeah. I mean, I wish, I always say, you know, when I say my story and everything, that I wish not everyone has to have experienced a relapse. But for me, it was my journey, and for me, it was a turning point. And I believe that you can use everything for the good, and you know, if you choose to. But you know, it's hard, because especially around alcohol as well, it's everywhere. You know, it's not like you can switch off from it. It's
yeah.
socially acceptable, you know. You just turn a corner and it's on a billboard, or it's in the, you know, people glamorize it, you know. But then I've got nothing against alcohol, but for someone like me, it doesn't work.
Yeah, well, you know, I can think of stories of people in church. For example, if your church is having a New Year's Eve party, and some churches will have alcohol licenses to have alcohol on the premises if it's a new building, and actually, you know, if you do that, there's sometimes questions need to be raised about, are you aware you might be excluding people in your congregation? So as you say, even in church culture often,
yeah.
there can be alcohol around. It's not even that church is always necessarily a sort of safe place away from that stuff.
And I understand, you know, communion, it's different, you know, if you are very clear, and a lot of places I go to these days will have an alternative as well, or just, you know, non-alcoholic communion. But yeah, I totally agree. It's about how we make things as safe as possible. And, you know, and I always say, why would people understand? Not like, it's a good thing that people don't, because it means that they've lived through it or know someone that has. So when I come across people that say, oh yeah, we'll have alcohol at this or we'll do that, I'm like, well, actually, it's, you know, I don't look down on people that think that way. It's just that they're not able to put themselves into the shoes of someone like myself, and thank goodness they haven't had to.
Yeah.
You know, the majority of my life, you know, apart from the last 10 years, has been horrendous. And I wouldn't wish that on anyone, but, you know, I just try and educate people today and through my story, but also through the work that I'm involved in. Sure. So
bring us up to date and tell us something of the, is it 10 years you've had since you've...
Yeah, well, 5 years ago I drank again for 2 weeks, and that was a really difficult period, but it was only 2 weeks. But actually looking back, it was, I wouldn't say I needed it, but I was able to really grow from that experience. And, you know, I really ploughed every effort I had into going to God with everything and growing in my sort of spiritual journey. And I mean, what had happened in those 2 weeks, I'd ended up smashing my car again. I was back drinking vodka. I literally ended up in a police cell, and I sat in this police cell, and I knew that I had two options. You know, one was to ask for help, that be, you know, from God and friends, or go straight back to drinking the minute I got out. And there's a saying in the Alcoholics Anonymous book, you know, a belly full of beer and a head full of AA doesn't work. And once you've had sobriety, that was the emotional sort of spiritual rock bottom I was talking about earlier. And it literally was, I was in bits. I was just, you know, and I got out of there and I reached, you know, I cried out to God to help me. And you know, I had some really good people around me, like my mother and different people, and, you know, I was able to stop. And then it was almost like I knew I wanted to just give my all to, you know, my spiritual journey around recovery. And I didn't know what that would look like. And goodness, I hadn't expected any of what's gone on in the last 5 years to have happened. And I kind of have to pinch myself a lot because I can't believe it.
Yeah.
And I like that because it keeps me humble, because, you know, people know me more than I know them now. But 6 weeks after the drinking episode, 5 years, it was over 5 years ago now, my mother had a cardiac arrest in front of me, a sudden cardiac arrest. And I was able, I won't go on about it, but I was able to do CPR on her. And in that moment when the paramedics took over, in the most horrific moment of my life, I was just praying. And I was saying like the serenity prayer that's used in the fellowships over and over again. And the paramedics were going to stop after 6 times, and I looked at them and I just said, you know, please can you do it one more time? This peace fell on me, and they did it one more time, and her heart started. And you know, she's alive to tell the tale, and I've been able to be a daughter to her and love her back to health. And you know, I looked after her. She relocated here, and she now runs the family work alongside the recovery course that I run.
So tell us a bit about that now. And you say you sort of have to pinch yourself that you have for the last few years now been involved in ministry, in ministering to those who I guess have similar stories to the one that you have through the recovery course and the other things you're involved in. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I believe that the biggest reason that I'm doing what I'm doing is because I've turned everything negative into a positive, and it's that blessed to be a blessing stuff. And I found out about this church coming to Bournemouth, and I didn't have a home church. I was first aiding at festivals. I'd learnt to be a first aider after what happened with my mum, and that was my way of keeping in touch with people, Christian folk, and I'd go to Soul Survivor and first aid and all that. And I love that. And I got speaking to a woman who told me about this church coming on, I ended up saying, oh, that's very nice. You know, I'd like to go to a nice worshipful, you know, modern HDB church and keep my recovery separate. And then I got home and again, you know, I just forgot about it, to be honest. And then I met some people down at the beach watching the fireworks, and it happened to be the team from London that had come down, and they were starting the following day.
So, is it starting the church
plant?
Yeah,
the church, St Swithin's.
St Swithin's, the HDB church plant.
And I thought, you know, I'm one of these people that God often tells me a few times before I take notice.
I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah, and that's not a bad thing. It just reaffirmed that I was on the right path. So the following day I went to the meeting they had, and there was like, you know, not that many people, but it was the first meeting. And I just got involved from day one. It just felt right, you know. And I started building up, you know, friends in the community, helping with Alpha, was leading a group in Alpha with another lady, and the pastor, Tim, must have seen that I was, you know, had a heart for the released and the lost, and just because I've been through it, you know. And he asked me one day my story, and I told him a bit like we're talking now. And we'd had a gentleman come and speak at the church called Nigel Scalzi, who wrote the recovery course. And I really enjoyed his talk. It was, you know, really raw, really kind of, you know, no holds barred type thing. And he just asked me if I'd run the course. Mm. And Susie and I, this other lady at the time, she's no longer doing it, but we ran this course. And I thought it'd be a very small, low-key kind of thing. And I've run now 5 courses, looking to start another soon. We've had over 600 people come, which is, we're pretty sure it's the biggest Christ-centred recovery course known in the UK. I mean, it's blown my mind, you know. I work also for a local charity, but this is my voluntary role for the church. I became a ministry head for the church. I've recently been commissioned by the Bishop of Winchester to do the work I'm doing. You know, it's just ironic, and I said it to some people yesterday, but I used to pop round my neighbours who was a vicar and pinch his wine back in the day, you know, just to feed my habit.
Yeah.
And now I've been invited to go to like cathedrals and be licensed in by bishops. It's like, it's crazy.
What a turnaround.
It really, really is. It's a life beyond my wildest dreams, really, but it's because I'm doing it all for God. And when I see people get set free of addiction, it, you know, not just that, but then giving back to the community. And I say to people, it's like, you know, a lot of people in the fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous and things, they talk about a hole in the soul, you know, when they've got an addiction going on. And I just say, well, mine, for me, it's a cross-shaped hole that needed filling. And when we feel that, we're never alone. And a big part of addiction is that feeling different. So when you've got a good relationship with God, anything's possible.
I'm sorry we're out of time, but that's a wonderful place to leave it, Emma. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales. We'll be right back with another interview right after this.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue...
Jesus died so you could be rich.
Is the prosperity gospel a false gospel? Is TV's reality hit Love Island forbidden fruit or a wake-up call for Christians? And what happened when one woman set off to cycle the world and encountered God? Discover answers to these questions, plus opinions, news and much more in the August issue of Premier Christianity Magazine.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. The Profile is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith and testimony. It's brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine, which I edit. It's Premier Christianity Magazine. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue, you can go to our website, premierchristianity.com/freesample. It's a monthly magazine and we're very happy to send you one free copy. So make the most of that offer, premierchristianity.com/freesample. But today on The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio, I'm pleased to say I'm speaking to Neil O'Boyle. Neil is the National Director of Youth for Christ, a Christian charity reaching hundreds of thousands of young people with the gospel. Neil, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And understand, not only do you now head up Youth for Christ, but it was actually Youth for Christ which was very influential in you becoming a Christian.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'd love to hear some of your early story and how you first encountered Christ.
Okay, well, thank you. Yes, I come from an unchurched home where faith really wasn't on the table. We didn't really talk about anything to do with God. Had potentially very different values. And yeah, so with that being my background and the setup in which I was in and raised in, I lived a life where I was searching for meaning, like many, many, many young people are. You know, the two questions that we're all really wrestling with is, who am I and do I matter? And they were absolutely at the forefront of my own thinking as a teenager, which led to some poor decisions. And at 16, I was put into an at-risk center. And after I left that place, after they let me out, I lost all of my friends. But there was one geeky guy who just wouldn't leave me alone and was a real persistent pain, just turning up at our house continually wanting to see me. And I remember saying to my parents, listen, please don't let him in. And my parents said, listen, we're getting fed up with this. You need to see him. And so I did. I saw him and said, what do you want? And he said, well, listen, here's the deal. You come to something with me and I'll leave you alone. Now, I had no friends, and why I was bargaining with this guy, I don't know. But I agreed and said, okay, that can be the deal. I stupidly didn't ask what we were going to go to. I thought we might go to McDonald's or something like that. We turn up outside a church and I'm thinking, okay, maybe there's something cool in the hall. We go into the hall. It's full of young people, absolutely full of young people. But there were two people I instantly recognized, and they'd been in my school. They belonged to something called Youth for Christ. I didn't know what that was. I just thought they were part of a cult. They talked about Jesus all the time. They just seemed weird. I didn't want to be there at that point, but I knew the deal. And so I sat through what was, for me, quite a painful experience, because just these freaky Christians who just seemed so happy, and it was just so a million miles from where I was at. And someone got up and preached, and I didn't understand anything. Literally, I couldn't. It was just a different language. And then came that classic line that we all know. If there's anyone here tonight who doesn't know Jesus as the Lord and Savior, then they can do so. And I sat there thinking, what does that mean? I had no idea what that sentence meant at all. But there was something about it that grabbed me. And I remember saying, literally saying, okay, God, if you exist, you can take my stupid, pathetic life, because if you don't, I know I will. That's how dark life had got for me. And yeah, as soon as I prayed that, the message had gone up, it'd been received and responded to. And I knew that I was experiencing whoever I just communicated with right there in that moment. And I left a totally different person. Wow. Reason for that being, of course, that Jesus said, I've come to heal the brokenhearted, set the captives free, release the oppressed. And that is exactly what he did in that moment in my life. I've come to bring life and life in all its fullness. And that's what's happened. I left there totally different. Now absolutely in love with this person called Jesus, who I just didn't know before I'd walked in that building. And yeah, that's the impact Youth for Christ had on me.
Wow. And this was you growing up in the north of England?
Yeah, correct.
So you had this amazing encounter experience with God at a very young age. And what's remarkable is since that happening, it seems like I think you've been in Youth for Christ kind of ever since, haven't you? Your whole life you've been in one way or another working for Youth for Christ.
Yes. So almost. So as soon as I left school and went on to college, trained as a PE teacher. And then after that, I did an intern with Youth for Christ and got married, didn't have a job.
You met your wife in Youth for Christ.
I did. Look, you know more than anyone. This is really impressive. So I did. I met Joy. She was, and Joy, my wife, had been praying for me before I'd even gone to that Youth for Christ event. She'd heard about me through this friend of mine who was very persistent. And so she'd been praying for me even before I turned up. And so, yeah, but we met through that. Started dating. She moved to London to become a nurse, and I got married, went to London with her, didn't have a job. Youth for Christ said, you know what, we can't pay you anything, but if you want to start a Youth for Christ center, you can. So I thought, well, I really have nothing to do, so that is what I'll do. And started Greenwich Youth for Christ.
I think a lot of people will know of Youth for Christ. I understand there's even a connection to the late great Billy Graham.
Oh, absolutely. So Billy Graham was the founder of Youth for Christ. Well, the founder was a man called Tory Johnson in the States, but Billy Graham was the first youth worker, and he came over to Britain in 1946. Yeah. And off the back of a number of rallies, he started Youth for Christ in Birmingham.
I think most people will kind of have some understanding of Youth for Christ or YFC and say, okay, it's, you know, Billy Graham is involved in the founding, and obviously you're involved in evangelism with young people. That's probably as far as it goes for a lot of people. So do you want to unpack a little bit more about what Youth for Christ is at the moment?
Yes, as an organization, we're committed to two things. We're committed to young people and taking the good news. And that is our single focus. We are absolutely about partnership with the local church. We want to empower the local church to be more effective in their outreach to young people. But our single focus is to take the good news of Jesus to young people.
And you've done that all over the world, which is amazing. Look at the list of places you've been and ministering in parts of the Middle East, in Asia. You're now obviously based in the UK. So tell me a little bit about that time in kind of North Africa, Middle East. What took you out to that part of the world and what were you doing out there?
Yeah, so I was out there as a training director for Youth for Christ International. And so I did an awful lot of my time and work working with the persecuted church for people who their faith is a challenge, where freedom is an issue, where they don't have the ability to talk freely about their faith. And so really my role was to train them up in youth ministry. But I've got to tell you, so many times I turned up and would be working with them and I thought, I have got nothing to give. I've got everything to learn. And I just wanted to continually sit down and listen to their stories, to be inspired by what's going on in their situation and their lives. So my role was very minimal in their own journeys.
Yeah, I mean, you can only imagine, can't you, how you kind of relate to somebody who might have experienced some kind of persecution for being a Christian, and you're there in a sort of training scenario on how to help someone who, you know, their life could be in danger for sharing the gospel, and you're there to encourage them to share the gospel. I mean, that must have been quite a difficult thing to get your head around.
It was very difficult. It was also incredibly humbling to be in that environment. I remember with one particular country that we were, well, actually, I never went into that country. We would fly them out literally for their safety more than mine, because they follow the source. They want to know who you're going to see, so the authorities follow you. So we flew them out. And I remember just before going into the room with this particular group of people, who were all Christians, being told by the organizer, listen, let me introduce you to who you're going to see in there. Your translator today is now living in Canada because he found, as he was walking towards his car, his car blew up. There was a bomb. So he's now running for his very life and he's hiding. The girl over there, her dad was recently killed as a martyr. The guy next to her, his back has just been totally disfigured from torture. And then literally just went around the room describing everyone. And I was just so incredibly humble. And then he said, anyone that I've not introduced to you, well, they're informers. And so just be careful and be aware of that. And so that was really difficult for me to get my head around, how you could literally have informers in the same room. And I remember sharing and teaching and then asking if there were any questions. And at the end of it, just one hand went up. And the question was this, what is your name? Say it slowly and spell it. So I immediately knew who was asking that question. But afterwards, I said, could you explain this to me? How can you have informers in the room with us in what really is a secret gathering? And they said, well, listen, we're all encouraged to be able to share in what's going on. We have to tell about what's going on. And therefore, we decide who that's going to be. And we get very creative about what we're going to share. We don't lie, but we're just really careful. And so that's their role this week.
Wow. So they're careful about what they say because they know there are people in the room potentially informing on to the authorities.
Absolutely.
On what Christians are doing.
Absolutely.
And you find yourself in a room like that. What an incredible...
Well, yeah, but they themselves, the Christians, have to be part of the informing. So they work it out. How are we going to do this?
So how long were you ministering in that part of the world for?
Well, I've worked with the persecuted church. I lived in three countries in that particular period of time, but over a 15-year period.
Mm. And was it after that you then moved to Asia?
Yes. So I was the area director for Asia Pacific Youth for Christ. Our ministry started literally from Afghanistan, went right over across to Fiji with everything in between, including India and China. So it was quite a large area that we covered. We had about 30 Youth for Christ nations in those particular in that particular part of the world. And my role was to encourage our ministries, but also to develop new ministries. And we did. We got things going in some really exciting places.
Mm. And in those moments, is this a case of you sharing the gospel with young people, or is it a case of training young people to share the gospel with others, or a bit of both?
And so it's about our mission, and it's about making sure the mission of Youth for Christ is fulfilled. And so the role is to develop youth ministries that will do exactly that. So, for example, it would be working alongside India Youth for Christ, which is ginormous. It's a massive ministry in India, and they're doing a great job, and you just let them get on with it. Or it's about starting Youth for Christ in some, let's say, for example, Central Asia, where actually there hasn't been a ministry. And we now have Youth for Christ in all of the countries in Central Asia, which is very exciting.
How would you describe some of the lessons that you've learned as you've travelled around the world and you're back now in the UK? What are some of the things you've learned from Christians in other parts of the world that you think should inform how Christians in this country behave? Perhaps things that we could do differently or things we should be inspired by for Christian experience in other places?
I think there are a whole lot of things that I'd say I would have learned or I'm continuing to learn. But I think not being ashamed of the gospel is number one, and to be courageous with that, but not to be stupid at the same time. To be sensible in the risks that you take, knowing that the Holy Spirit is leading and guiding you, and when he's not, to keep quiet and to literally act on his leading. And I've seen that played out so many times. I've experienced that, but I've watched it at play many, many times.
I know one of the distinctives about YFC is that everyone who works for you will be asked to fundraise for half of their salary, which is quite a task, I imagine, yourself included. You know, half of your salary will be through you fundraising. Where did that idea kind of come from, and what have been the challenges in working that one out?
Well, I've no idea where it came from. That predates me, but The reason behind that is so that we all share in the mission, so that we have ownership on the mission, so that we really are invested in it. And so, yeah, there is a burden piece. We recognize that. And it's a nightmare to recruit, because you've got to say to people, listen, great that you want the job, but you've got to raise half your salary. Now, just to clarify, if someone doesn't raise half their salary, they still get their salary.
Right.
We just want them to really own part of this mission with us, and the burden of the financial responsibilities that we have to undertake to carry something like Youth for Christ, which is financially, it's quite draining.
Yeah. Well, I imagine maybe there are some similar crossovers with evangelism and fundraising. I mean, both an evangelist and a fundraiser is trying to convince someone, trying to persuade someone either to turn to Christ or to hand over some cash. So maybe there are some similarities there, or is it not that simple? And is it actually a completely different skill set?
I think it's not that simple, no, because it's about the vision, isn't it? So when it comes to fundraisers, we're sharing the vision is about seeing young people's lives changed by Jesus. So if that excites you and you want to get behind that, then please do fundraise or support us in that task. But evangelism, it's about literally presenting the gospel, knowing that Jesus can change your life.
Is there not a bit of convincing that happens at the same time? I mean, you present the gospel, the truth of the gospel, but you then have to persuade someone to believe it, don't you?
No, we don't do that at all. That's the Holy Spirit. And so our role in this, and this is it's a really good point you're making, because we have some very, very gifted communicators. But I would take average communicators every single day who are connected to the vine, who are literally connected to Jesus. And the fruit of Jesus is just clearly evident in their lives, because it's about the Holy Spirit working through individuals. And that's where the real long-lasting impact comes, to our staff who just deeply love Jesus and are connected to him. And the fruits are evident and at work. And you see it as they share the gospel. Lives are changed. You can have a brilliant communicator give a very clever and clear message with no lasting impact. We want to see lives changed by Jesus, and we want to see Jesus working in and through our staff.
Sure. Ideally, though, wouldn't you want both? You'd want someone who's connected to the vine, who's connected with Jesus, but also is a good communicator and a good persuader.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we do have that at Youth for Christ. We have some very gifted evangelists, for sure. But they know that character comes before competence if you're going to work for Youth for Christ.
Tell me some more about YFC's work with young offenders. This is something you do that people may not be aware of.
We do. So we work in a number of prisons across this country, and we work with other organizations doing training for them so that they can be effective in their own outreach in prisons. And we have a number of staff who that is their job every single day. They're in a prison context sharing Jesus. We do life skill training, but we also do chapel. And we are quite deliberate about the fact that we are Christians, we love Jesus, and we believe that Jesus can bring hope into the darkest of situations. And we see that playing out continually. We see and hear about young people's lives who are just literally being transformed. We had one guy who was just a real hardened guy who was in for a long time, and he made a decision to follow Jesus, and he was just so passionate about his new faith that he just went from cell to cell to cell, just telling everyone about Jesus. And so they renamed him and they called him Jesus. When he was eventually let out, it's really interesting because when he was eventually let out, his parole officer said, listen, the most important thing we can do for you is to get you a job. If you don't get a job, your chances of reoffending are much greater. And so he said, okay. And they did. They got him a job. And he turned around and said, I'm really sorry, I can't take that job. And they said, why? He said, well, because it requires me to work on a Sunday and I'm a Christian and I want to go to church on a Sunday. And so they said, well, then it's over to you. We've done our bit. That's your problem. So he said, okay. He did get a job. It didn't require him to work on a Sunday. He goes to church every Sunday. He's just recently been baptized. And this guy is just so in love with Jesus. And we just see our staff taking the good news and bringing hope and seeing lives change on a continual basis. In fact, one of them called Mick, who is just a real rough and ready Youth for Christ worker in a prison context, was passionately sharing the gospel in chapel. And as he's sharing, he does an appeal in a classic way. And unbeknown to him at the time, two prison guards hear that message and give their lives to Jesus.
You do hear some amazing stories, I think particularly of things like Alpha in prisons. You kind of hear sometimes secondhand, third-hand stories of, wow, there's some really exciting things going on. But you don't always get the details like the story you just shared. How much of this is a kind of good news story that isn't being talked about?
Yeah, so we do have the right to be able to take and share the gospel, and a prisoner has the right to be able to express their faith. And so it's in that context that we do that. Now, we do other things as well, such as life skill training, which we talked about. And that often dovetails into, we meet young offenders in that context, and then they, you know, they like our staff and want to come to chapel and hear about the gospel or a Bible study. And so, you know, metaphorically, the doors are somewhat open. You have to be careful and you have to be responsible and you have to have a good relationship with the governor in the prison. Should you not, then the door will close very quickly on you. And I think we strike that balance really well. And we take that, you know, with real responsibility.
I imagine there's a lot of wisdom needed in not just that, perhaps schools work as well, where you're working with different authorities and they will welcome you in. But at the same time, you have to be respectful of the kind of guidelines and even laws surrounding what you can
Absolutely.
And can't say to young people.
Absolutely.
So give me a bit of an insight into how that kind of works and some of those decisions.
Yes, so I would say the majority of what Youth for Christ does at our centre levels, we have 70 plus centres across this country, would mainly be in schools. Not all of it is schools work, but a good chunk of it is, where schools literally welcome us with open arms. One of the challenges that a lot of schools have is literally the teaching of Christianity under Ofsted. One of the areas where things really are a struggle is in the teaching of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so often outside groups and churches are asked to come in and to help. And so we willingly do that. We do many, many other things in the schools as well. But that is one of the things that we do. In fact, there's one school in the north of England, 98% Muslims, was struggling to meet the requirements of Ofsted when it came to the teaching of Christianity. The teacher himself didn't really understand Christianity, asked us to come in, speak about the Good Samaritan. It was a lesson, talk about our perspective of a God of love. We did that. Off the back of that, he said, listen, the only thing I've got to go off is something called REQuest, which is a website about Christianity, and it's set around the curriculum. He said, I don't know who does that. And a Youth for Christ staff worker said, well, we do that. That's our website. And he said, really? He said, listen, I'd love you to come back into this school. And so we did. We established a relationship with that school, 98% Muslim. So much so that our Youth for Christ staff worker was invited to be a governor, the only Christian part of the governor team. And very recently, that school has just won an outstanding award by the Church of England for the teaching of Christianity.
You mentioned that it's 98% Muslim, and this is something I wanted to ask you about. Some would argue that the church in this country is not very well equipped at all at the moment for specifically reaching out to Muslims, and how that might require a different kind of evangelism to, for example, ministering to an atheist or witnessing to someone of another religion. So how well equipped do you think the average Christian is at the moment for dealing with the kinds of objections that Muslims will have to the Christian faith?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I think we do struggle. I think if I'm really honest, like I go back to that event that I went to, a Youth for Christ event in 1988, where I heard the gospel proclaimed, and thought, what is this language they're talking? So even among Christians, we struggle with our own vocabulary. So when it comes to other faiths, then yeah, we probably really, really struggle. But I think My own experience of living overseas, particularly in a cross-cultural experience, mm-hmm. has been it's about relationships. It's about authenticity. It's about getting to know people and for them to see that something different about you, for that to be the conversation starter. You know, the commonality, though, is faith. So people of other faiths are not closed to what we got to say. Actually, that is the thing that's going to draw us together. It's when you get into apologetics, which actually becomes really unhelpful, I think, one-on-one, because that then each party is just defending their own perspective and they're not really listening to the other. So I think it's about genuine relationships where they can see prayers being answered and at work and God at work in your life.
You say apologetics is unhelpful.
Well, I'm not saying apologetics are unhelpful in its own right. I think when you have a gathering and someone like Ravi Zacharia turns up, you know, or even here with Ruth Jackson, who's an amazing apologist, actually, your editor for Youth and Children's Magazine. I think when people listen to two people discussing different perspectives, that's very different and incredibly effective. What I'm saying is one-on-one, it can become unproductive.
What, it can become a sort of shouting match?
It becomes an argument
people.
Quite often.
Yeah, but isn't all apologetics a bit of an argument? I mean, even on the sort of large scale where you've got particularly gifted apologists, a lot of the stuff they do in debate format, it is an argument, isn't
it? Yeah, but the audience doesn't have to defend their views, where the person on the stage does, or one-on-one you're defending your views. But do I believe in apologetics? Absolutely, of course I do.
Not everyone does, that's why I bring it up.
No, I definitely do. And we need people who are going to be able to answer really difficult questions. Completely, absolutely.
I guess for you, you just place the emphasis a little bit more on building a personal relationship with someone as the kind of starting point before worrying about the tough questions.
Yeah, and the tough questions come. And so our staff need to be equipped and our volunteers need to be able to equip to answer those questions. But they need to be born most of the time out of relationship.
I know the other thing you're really passionate about, I think you wrote about this for Youth and Children's Work magazine. You mentioned the editor, Ruth Jackson. I think what you were specifically addressing in this article was the idea of sugarcoating the gospel, that sometimes we're a little bit reluctant to be bold and to be brave. Perhaps again in this country, many Christians they're not so bold when it comes to doing those things. So talk a bit more about that and how we can overcome, I think, a lot of fear from some Christians to want to step out in some of these things.
Well, I think so. I lived overseas for 18 years. When I came back, I noticed two significant differences. One was the way we do discipleship, and then the second one was that we'd stopped talking about Jesus and we'd moved away from evangelism to mission, the mission being much more about demonstrating Jesus. But in our demonstration and doing acts of kindness and engaging with our communities, we're still not necessarily talking about who Jesus is. And so for me, it's about bringing the two together, evangelism, mission, demonstrating and declaring. They need to go together. And I think that's really at the heart of what I was addressing there, is that we shouldn't just be doing great acts of kindness in our community and our community has no idea who we are. We actually need to be able to say, well, you know, the reason that motivates me is my love for Jesus.
It is an interesting trend, the kind of the social action trend within the church that I think we've seen over the last 10 years, maybe a bit more than that now. Things like food banks, street pastors, all of these good works that Christians are doing, they're all relatively new, aren't they? Even the kind of debt advice that a lot of churches will offer,
which is great.
But this is the question more and more Christians are asking, is it's great that we're perhaps increasingly known for these things, but are we getting across our distinct beliefs? Are we getting across the gospel through our words as much as our actions? Perhaps it's easier to show God's love through actions than it is words.
Yeah, of course it is. And I'm not saying we shouldn't, and we absolutely should be about demonstrating Jesus, and we should be about helping our communities. And there's a report about to come out by Barna that actually explores just that and how the community views the church and its relevance. And we need to be relevant, we absolutely do, but we also have a message. We have a message that brings about transformation. We have a message which has an eternal ramification, and we need not to hide behind demonstrating. We need to be declaring as well. Now, I'm not saying we stand on street corners. I'm not saying that at all. I'm simply saying we need to be a little bolder in bringing Jesus into our conversations, because Jesus is the one who brings change and transformation.
Yeah. So what are the most common objections that you hear amongst young people to the gospel?
No, I don't think there is. I think the real interesting thing right now is that he's simply not on the agenda. So it's not that there's an objection. It's, you know, who is Jesus? Really, now is the question. When I was growing up, I knew who Jesus was. Now he's like, you know, he's somehow related to Gandhi in some way or other. You know, he's an important guy, but who's Gandhi? No idea who Gandhi is. Who's Jesus? No idea who Jesus is. And so, you know, 32% of young people, off our own research, Gen Z Rethinking Culture, 32% of young people declare that they believe in God. Now, when we really delved into the stats and the reading behind that, what it really told us that for the remaining young people, it wasn't that they didn't believe in God. It wasn't that they were atheists. It's simply that God wasn't on the agenda. Mm. It's just not at the forefront of their thinking. This really
is. Is that because there's just so many distractions nowadays for young people that they just don't ask the big questions?
Yeah, possibly. But I think this is also the first truly post-Christian generation that we've seen. So this is a generation of young people who have literally never been brought up in a church culture.
Does that come with positives, though? Because it means there aren't any wrong understandings or misunderstandings that we'd have to unpick like perhaps we used to have to.
I think your starting point's different. So that's the difference. Yes. So they really don't have preconceived ideas. For many, if they're raised in a church school, then that's slightly different. But, you know, and again, I go back to the teaching of RE, and I just applaud RE teachers. But it's a very, very difficult task to effectively be able to communicate Christianity in a relevant manner in a classroom setting.
So what tends to happen if that isn't being done? What is the kind of teaching that typically
I think it is being done, but it's curriculum based. And so I think for us, it's about introducing people to a life faith that works. And that's of course our message.
I want to put a kind of scenario to you, which is a real one that I heard. I've obviously changed some of the details. But this was a church that was putting on an outreach event to young people at Christmas time. And so the Christian young people invited their non-Christian friends to a Christmas party, was basically what the church said it was. Great. And so people came along to a Christmas party, one Muslim girl was there. During this Christmas party, they kind of stopped the party elements and did a 20 or 30 minute talk, evangelistic talk on why you need to repent, why Jesus is the only way to God, mentioned hell, topics that obviously made some non-Christians in the room quite uncomfortable. And it was sort of debated afterwards in this church, well, hang on, I thought this was a Christmas party, and did we not invite people to one thing and they're expecting a party and they kind of got another? And this split opinion, because you'll have those who say, well, you know, the gospel is offensive and actually we've got to share the gospel with non-Christians and this was a good way of doing it. And you have others who say, well, this felt slightly wrong in that they were coming for one thing and got another. And I don't think this is a kind of isolated example. I think many churches have done this. Many churches would disagree with that approach. Many would agree. In that sort of a scenario, you know, what's the right way forward for Christians in seeking to reach out? Is that an appropriate way of sharing our faith?
Yes, great question. So I'm not familiar with that particular case.
Sure, and it's slightly hypothetical. I've changed some of the details, but I think generally this is the sort of approach some churches will take.
And I think our answer is that we need to be transparent. So if we're running events, let's be clear about what we're trying to achieve, and let's not surprise our guests. If we are going to give a message, let's tell them that's going to happen. So be clear about it. Be relevant. That sounds like a really bad gear change to me. But I wasn't there, so yeah, I can't speak into that.
But you think that, you know, we should always say with our kind of promotional activity up front beforehand, this is a Christmas party. There'll also be a short talk about the Christian faith.
Yeah, I think that's totally acceptable.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because, I think the pushback on that will be people saying, but if you put that on the literature, no one will turn up. And some people feel like we have to use a bit of a cloak and dagger effect, otherwise there'll never be any non-Christians.
Well, I think the question is what got them there in the first place. So you putting a poster outside a building isn't going to do it. It's going to be the relationships that have already been established. Mm-hmm. So that's really the more important journey, is that the individual is bringing them there, far more than what actually happens in that building. What we need to make sure is that what we communicate in that building isn't going to drive a wedge between that relationship that the Christian has with the non-church Christian. That's important, and we need to preserve that and encourage that.
There are Christians who've sat where you're sitting right now and done interviews with us here at Premier, and they've spoken very excitedly and very passionately. They believe that revival is coming to this country, and that the tide is kind of going to turn. Would you sort of back that sort of view? Is that something you feel that could be on the way?
I don't know, is my honest answer to that question. But am I seeing Some interesting trends. Yeah, I am. And we as an organisation are, you know, The Message, another great organisation, with their Hire tour in the Midlands. They had 3,000 young people turn up to hear The Message. That's incredible. We are seeing our own events, lots of unchurched people turn up for it. But are we seeing revival? No, we're not seeing revival. Are people responding to the gospel? Yes, they are. Is it harder than it has been in the past? I would say it is. Mm. But the opportunities are still there. This country is amazing. I've worked in places where we don't have the freedom we have. Mm. We need to be respectful about the freedom we've got, and we need to be relevant in how we communicate. But it's there for us to be able to express our faith. It's there for us to be able to say, you know what, to a secular society, we have the right to put God back on the agenda. We have the right to talk about issues of faith. So let's do that.
Well, Neil, it's been fascinating to chat. Just before I leave you, I'd love to hear, what are your future plans for YFC?
Well, we have a number. I have a team that just come up with ideas every single day. It's crazy. They're just so creative. So we're really going to push into the digital. And we have a campaign where we hope to be able to reach 1 million young people by using the digital in this country. So it'll have wider ramifications, because the digital world is without borders. So that's going to be exciting. But for young people in Britain, we want to push into families, because we recognize actually every year at holiday clubs, people hear the gospel, children hear the gospel, make decisions, and then they go back into their households who are unchurched, and what happens? We want to bridge that and make a connection there that is relevant and long-lasting. We got all sorts of plans when it comes to our schools work about how we can be more effective.
And where can people go if they want to find out more or support what you're doing?
Great. They can go to yfc.co.uk.
Wonderful. Well, Neil O'Boyle, thank you so much for joining us today on The Profile. It's been great to have you.
Brilliant. Thank you.
That was my interview with Neil O'Boyle from Youth for Christ. If you'd like to hear more great interviews with Christians from all walks of life, why not check out The Profile podcast? Just search for The Profile on your podcast provider, or visit premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. And if you are currently listening to this as a podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would give us a rating and a review, again, wherever you found this podcast. That would really help us out. Before we go, a final reminder that this show is brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine. It's Premier Christianity magazine. And if you would like a free sample copy of our latest edition, which features a cover story on the prosperity gospel and a culture column on Love Island, then why not head to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Simply type your details in and we will happily send you a copy of the latest issue completely free of charge. Just time left to thank you once again for joining us on The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. It's been great to have you with us. We will be back at the same time next week.
Save big money on your roofing project at Menards with Owens Corning Shingles. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements and enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 24 colors of Owens Corning Duration Shingles and transform your home today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.